Penguin Random House Audio presents The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. This is the author, Mark Sundin. For Cedar, who showed me what to say. The danger of civilization, of course, is that you will piss away your life on nonsense. Jim Harrison. The only way to deal with an unfree world is to become so absolutely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion. Albert Camus. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. Merle Haggard. Introduction. By the time the train approached the station, night had fallen. Sarah gathered her bags and descended the stairs to the luggage rack. Her husband helped slide an unwieldy cardboard box toward the door. The steel floor rocked beneath her shoes. The conductor's voice crackled over the loudspeaker. "This is not a smoking stop, folks. Unless this is your final destination, please stay on board the train. The next smoking stop will be Kansas City." Sarah peered out the window but saw only her reflection. She turned to the woman beside her. "Are you from here?" The woman said she was. "Can you see the stars here?" "Oh, yes," said the woman. "They're beautiful." Sarah and Ethan had spent 2 nights on the train. First, they rode the Silver Meteor from Fort Lauderdale to Washington, a 22-hour haul. Then 19 hours to Chicago aboard the Capital Limited. Had she sifted through newspapers discarded on seats by fellow passengers, Sarah might have seen an item concerning the bankruptcy of the nation's second-largest subprime mortgage lender, the most recent in a string of nearly 50 such failures. In other news, a senator named Barack Obama had announced a bid for the presidency. Steve Jobs had unveiled a device called the iPhone, its failure quickly forecast. Nothing more than a luxury bauble that will appeal to a few gadget freaks. Sarah had slept some, lulled by the clicking of the rails and the muffled whump each time a bridge flexed beneath the car. She was hungry. During these final 4 hours aboard the Southwest Chief, she had eaten the last of the peanut butter from Florida. The train had smelled of disinfectant when it left Chicago, but as the passengers began to snore beneath blankets, sprawled in their seats, the air had thickened and gone stale. Through Illinois, Sarah had gazed down at backyards and country lanes, but once the sun had set, the window allowed no glimpses of her new home. She was as giddy as a bride. The train shuddered to a stop, and the conductor slid open the steel door and placed a set of portable yellow stairs on the platform. An icy wind nipped Sarah's ears as she stepped into the white pool of light. Sarah and Ethan wrestled the cardboard box off the train, piled it with the rest of their belongings. The train whistled and chugged into the night. The smattering of departing passengers was whisked away by waiting cars. The frozen air smelled of wet wood. Sarah cut open the box with a pocket knife. Inside were bicycle parts. Resting a frame upside down on the concrete, she attached the wheels and brake cables. Her breath hovering in clouds, she flipped the bike and threaded the seat post into its orifice and tightened the clamp. By the time both bikes were ready, the station was empty. Fingers of trees stretched toward the dark sky. The whole place could be swallowed by the night. They hung panniers and fastened backpacks to the racks. Sarah zipped her jacket, snugged a wool stocking cap beneath her helmet, inserted her hands into warm gloves. After studying a folded photocopy of a map under the lamps of the platform, Sarah and Ethan crossed the tracks and pedaled into town. They glided between the plain white clapboard cottages, a distant streetlight shimmering in a halo of mist. Sarah felt awkward, as if she had misassembled her bike. With each pump, her knees bumped against her belly. But it was not her bicycle that had changed. It was her body. She was in her 5th month. 3 months earlier, she and Ethan had compiled a list of 20 criteria for a home, a place to begin their family. Among other things, they intended to grow as much of their own food as was possible. So they listed year-round drinking water source, long growing season with ample rainfall, Those requirements alone had eliminated huge swaths of the country. The northern plains were too wintry, the southwest too dry. Another goal was to live without electricity and petroleum. That did not mean they would generate power with solar panels or wind turbines. They simply would not have it. No hot water heater, refrigerator, furnace, washing machine, computer, or cell phone. No light bulbs. They added to the list. Existing structures not wired for electricity. No building codes to allow building with natural materials. Sarah and Ethan would not use cars or airplanes. They would rely on walking, bikes, and public transport. They wanted to be fewer than 5 miles from a train station, within biking distance of a college town. They also listed criteria of purely personal preference. Sarah was a classically trained soprano and wanted a town where she could sing opera. As for Ethan, a former marine biologist raised in a Massachusetts fishing town, he hoped to be near the sea. Ethan and Sarah already knew of a place that met most of their criteria, the forested hills of Cottage Grove, Oregon, where they had rented a homestead for 5 years and Sarah had sung in the chorus of Carmen. A generation ago, they probably would have bought the 30-acre compound of forest and garden, with its long summer days and cool, dry nights. But back to the land havens in Oregon and California and Vermont had long since been discovered. The property would have cost $500,000. And so one essential criterion effectively precluded ocean and opera: affordable land. Their pickings were slim. The parts of America without national parks and bike paths had natural food stores. Ethan had cycled across the United States and not found Missouri to his liking. Flat and buggy and landlocked, humid summers and bitter winters. Alas, Missouri it was. A friend found an 80-acre Amish farm for sale. 100-year-old bungalow, barn, shop, 2 ponds, a hardwood forest, plenty of pasture and fertile soil. Devoid of tide pools and Bel Canto, the sparsely populated northeastern corner of Missouri, shoehorned between Iowa and Illinois, nailed the other 18 criteria. And the bubble of land speculation had not reached it. Ethan and Sarah paid $160,000, cash, sight unseen, for the house, barn, and all 80 acres. Which is how they had come to arrive on an April night in La Plata, Missouri, population 1,467, a once prosperous trading post along the Santa Fe Railway, now fallen on hard times. They cycled through the town square, doorways dark, wind rattling the leafless trees. The upstairs windows of the storefronts were boarded with plywood and corrugated fiberglass. Tacked to the door of an auction house was a list of farm implements and an inventory of tools and appliances with a brief preamble. As I am residing in a nursing home, we'll sell the following items. In the window of one of the few functioning enterprises, the Christian Ministries Clothing Center, was taped a terse, hand-scrawled note: no TVs. Sarah did not share her husband's aversion to the Midwest. Although born and raised a city girl in Houston, singing at a performing arts school, speeding over freeways to coffee shops, working out at the gym, Sarah came from deep Iowa stock. Her parents were born there. Her great-grandparents had been farmers, and their parents homesteaders, just like in Little House on the Prairie. Sarah had graduated from Grinnell College, 150 miles north of here. Moving to Missouri felt like coming home. The beam of her headlamp projected a meager saucer of gray on the asphalt. After a series of left-hand turns, the couple had to admit they were lost. They pedaled toward a glimmer, which materialized into a gas station bathed in neon along a highway. A police cruiser idled out front. The couple went inside to ask directions, and the officer told them that all they needed to do was cross the highway to a gravel road named Mockingbird Hill. They mounted their bikes an inch to the shoulder. But Sarah could see no outlet on the far side of the four lanes. A truck roared past, rattling her teeth. "I don't see where we're supposed to go," she said. Just then the red lights of the cruiser flashed behind them. The officer crawled forward, the big engine purring, and Sarah saw him smile from the open window. "Follow me," he said. He escorted them across four lanes to where, sure enough, a gravel road descended from the embankment past a graveyard and into farmland. Keeping a respectful distance
Sample complete. Ready to continue?